So here we are, and come on, let's see now. This says,
Don, I'll bet the word snow does not appear in the Quran.
I don't remember reading it in the Quran. You're right. I do not remember that. Today is the 7th, according to my computer. I thought it was later than that. Okay, fine. It's the 7th. February 7th, 2021. You know, I still sign checks 19. I start off 19.
Yeah. So,
only
19, you mean like from 20-some years ago?
Yeah, only quarter of a century behind. But you know, that's better than usual. I'm usually in the BC area.
19 followed by the space.
So anyway, we're in the middle of, today we're going to finish up. I'm sort of schmoozing into the next topic. Of course, we've been talking about the 25 prophets of Islam, or at least the 25 most important prophets, depending on which sect of Islam you're talking about. You know, are there just 25 prophets, or are there 25 really important prophets? That's sort of the question. And so, of course, I've taken that as the sort of the central theme of the Quran, just this whole concept of prophethood. And of course, many, many weeks ago, I mean, this is January, so we started in September. We began with Adam, the first prophet, and we continued on through all the others, and we have now reached Muhammad. This is our, third or fourth week talking about Muhammad. And remember, initially, we were pointing out that most of the, obviously there's a lot of, I've left out a lot of passages where God is just talking to Muhammad. So, you know, you've seen that all the time, you know, say, blah, 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 what God is telling Muhammad to say. But I tried to at least identify all the passages in which Muhammad is referred to explicitly, you know, just as another prophet. And interestingly, overwhelmingly, those passages, as a Christian, I guess, I read it as a sort of, with a subtext in there, Muhammad is not divine, is not a miracle worker, is not a seer, is not sinless, you know, all those kind of things. So the subtext I read there, whether correctly or not, but I think correctly, is that, well, golly, you know, he's the greatest of the prophets, of course. And what does that say about Jesus then, who doesn't have the status of Muhammad and all these Christians who attribute divinity and sinlessness and all that sort of thing to Jesus, when Muhammad is, you know, the seal of the prophets? That's the other big text. And yet he's not sinless, he's not divine and all that sort of stuff, you know. So I can't help but sort of see an anti-Christian polemic by implication in there. And I wouldn't surprise me at all, because, of course, part of what's going on, and we of course, reviewed Jesus as prophet number 24, and, of course, we reviewed all that stuff that the Quran says about Jesus, and, of course, it does indeed, when you get there, say that, you know, he was not divine and all that other stuff, wasn't really crucified, whatever. Those are the salient attributes of Muhammad. But then we went on to talk about Muhammad's book. And of course, an Orthodox Muslim wouldn't countenance that phrase, Muhammad's book. It's God's book. Muhammad is simply the vehicle for transmitting that book, which is eternal and exists in heaven, to his fellow countrymen. And so I've tried to find all the self-references in the Quran where it talks about itself, and we have reviewed two of the three that I have, and the first one, remember, is that the Quran is eternal. There is a book in heaven, whether that book consists of just the Quran or more stuff, and the Quran is part of it, whatever. At any rate, this was not created when Muhammad recited it. I mean, that's the whole point, that Muhammad is not simply, you know, creating a brand new book. No, Muhammad is just a vehicle, nothing more. Muhammad got these revelations from God through Gabriel, and is simply reciting what's already there in heaven and has been from eternity and will be from eternity. Reciting it to his fellow Meccans and then people in Medina. So the Quran is eternal. That's characteristic number one of the Quran. The second one that I talked about is, and this was the one that elicited, well, I wasn't really talking about the Quran at the time, but it's related. It elicited that controversy in my Islamic and Jewish philosophy class last semester. The Quran is perfectly clear, it says. Perfectly clear. You know, I'm writing in the vernacular. You know, I'm talking to you in Arabic, and it's all getting written down. Muhammad, remember, was supposedly illiterate, so he was simply reciting it to somebody, and somebody else was writing it down. Okay, fine. But at any rate, the point is, the language being used here is the vernacular. This is not like, you know, in the late Middle Ages or whatever, during the Renaissance, and the Catholic Church was fixated on Latin, and people didn't know, you know, were losing their facility with Latin and whatever. This is in the vernacular. Everybody should be able to understand it. You have no excuse if you can't understand what I'm saying. So it's absolutely clear. And then that student of mine in the class raised that objection and said, well, you know, the Quran is really rather obscure and you need to consult the experts and so forth. And I then made a threefold distinction in reply. And I said, well, it depends on what you mean by mean. Right? When you talk about meaning of the Quran, when you say, what does it mean? What do you mean by the word mean? and if you mean that you need to consult a philologist because we're talking about a language now that's 1,400 years old, well, sure, of course you do. You know, that's nothing wrong with consulting experts there. And if you mean by that we don't understand the theological significance of it, well, once again, that's fine to consult the experts who are more attuned and more capable of formulating a consistent theological framework. That's fine too. And when the Quran says this is perfectly clear, it's not talking about that sort of stuff. I mean, certainly Muhammad. I really don't think that Muhammad was worried about, in 1,400 years, gee whiz, are we going to understand what we're talking about? I don't think that Muhammad had any conception of linguistic change, for one thing, you know. So that just wasn't on his radar. And as far as theological constructions go, the Quran is not theology. I'll take a page from John Henry Newman, who made a very interesting, this was, I think, in the Apologia pro vita sua, I believe, but where he says the Bible contains no theology. The Bible contains the data for theology. So it makes theology kind of like physics, you know, and then the Bible is kind of like the experiments and the observations on which physics is based. Physics provides the theory that explains the data. Well, similarly, theology provides the theory that explains the scriptural data. And we can apply, I think, that same distinction to Islam. You know, so the Quran doesn't contain theology. It contains the data for theology. The later people who came along and tried to construct a consistent system were doing theology. They were trying to explain what was in the Quran, but the Quran itself, and Muhammad, that means, was not particularly concerned with theology as such, constructing a consistent system at all. All he's doing, at least so he claims, all I'm doing is reciting what I was told by Angel Gabriel from God. That's all I'm doing. Whether it's consistent or not, what the implications are, that's not on his radar either. So there's nothing wrong with consulting experts there. But that third possible meaning about what do you mean by X has to do with the exegesis of a given passage. And here, indeed, that statement that the Quran is absolutely clear does have a bearing on that. Let me give you an example, and we talked about this a little bit last time, but let me give you another example. You know the sort of the Islamic motto, so to speak, There is no God but Allah and Muhammad his prophet. You know that. Well, that statement doesn't appear as such in the Quran, but it does appear fragmentarily in different places. The point is, the first half of that statement appears in various places, and the second half of that statement appears in various other places. But let me read you one of the main places about the first half of the statement and comment on it a little bit. This is in Surah number 47, verse 20. Know therefore that there is no God other than Allah, and ask forgiveness for thy frailties and for believing men and believing women, and Allah knows the place where you move about and the place where you stay. Okay, fine. But that first clause, know therefore that there is no God other than Allah. Yeah. Well, now let's imagine ourselves in Muhammad's shoes here, or whatever he wore. Let's imagine ourselves, you know, in 7th century Mecca. He's delivering this. Somebody comes along, and this person who has heard this and did not abandon the ancestral religion, and comes up before God, say, and is being weighed in the balance. Are you a believer or are you a disbeliever? Is the question, you know? And this person says, so God says, you know, well, you're gonna be spending the rest of eternity in hell, writhing in pain because of the fires of hell. And this person says, well, that's not very fair. And then God says, did not Muhammad convey to you there is no God other than Allah? And this person says, well, yeah, I heard that. But I thought it meant that Allah, you know, was the most important God. It didn't seem to me to be inconsistent with what our ancestors have been doing. And so I just continued on with that. What I did do, though, I made sure to honor Allah with special honor because of Muhammad's, what Muhammad said. And then God would simply say in reply, there is no way you can construe that statement in the way you have construed it, honestly. You know, you can't possibly. When it's, you know, look, what does it say? It says, know therefore that there is no God other than Allah. How can that possibly bear the construction, oh, Allah is just the greatest of the gods? How can you possibly get that out of this? You know, there are limits to how you can construe statements, and that one certainly is beyond the pale. Look, what about that? What about 8 or 9 words? Which word there do you not understand? Right? So, yeah, the Quran is, and that's no doubt what Muhammad meant by saying, you know, the Quran is delivered in clear Arabic. Statements like that, it's pretty hard to misunderstand what that says. It's not obscure, right? That's what he meant. And, or that's what God meant, according to Muhammad. And that has implications. Now, I don't think Muhammad was thinking about this, but that has implications for later theological controversies. The context in which that question came up in my class I was referring to was we were talking about al-Ghazali at the time and his polemic against the Shiites and also against the philosophers, but I think it was in the context of the Shiites that this came up. And the Shiite, at least the Shiite group that he was inveighing against, and certainly the philosophers, were intent on allegorical interpretation of the Quran. Just as an example, take Al-Farabi, one of the earlier philosophers, you know, in talking about the afterlife, interprets reward and punishment as purely psychological. And so he would have to say, when you come to verses like, you know, the fire, referring to the fire in the case of damnation and the gardens in the case of salvation, he would have to interpret those allegorically, right? The garden simply refers to, that word refers to the delight that the souls, disembodied souls, have in the afterlife. And the fire simply refers to the psychological torment that they have in reflecting on their passions, and they no longer can satisfy their passions and stuff like that. And Al-Ghazali was saying in response, look, fire, guess what it means? It means fire. And gardens, guess what they mean? They mean gardens, you know. And although I don't think that Muhammad had that sort of thing in mind when this was written, because those things were not in the air yet. This is, you know, the very beginning of Islam. So this is all stuff that, you know, happened centuries after Muhammad died. Still, I think that insistence that the Quran is clear does indeed relate to that third possible meaning of the word. What does it mean? Because we're talking about the exegesis of a certain passage. In other words, is it intended to be literally true, or is it symbolic somehow? And the Shiites and the philosophers tended to gravitate toward a more symbolic interpretation of it, whereas the Asharites, of which Al-Ghazali was one, tended to insist more on the literal meaning of the passage. And I think they would have some scriptural authority for that in the Quran's self-proclamation that this is completely clear. And that's what it means. It means what it means. It doesn't mean something that's an allegory of some kind. So anyway, that was the second of the three attributes of the Quran, according to my notes at least. And then the third one is really neat. It's really interesting, I think. And this is a fairly famous doctrine of abrogation. So let's look at a few verses for that. There are four of them that I have listed here. And the first is 2:107. Let me see now. Which color is it? It's probably FYI here. Yeah. Okay. Here you go. Okay. 2:107. Whatever sign we abrogate or cause to be forgotten, we bring one better than that or the like thereof. Dost thou not know that Allah has the power to do all that he wills? Whatever sign we abrogate or cause to be forgotten, we bring one better or one like that, it says. Well, that's the first one. Let's see. Second one is 1783. Let's see. FYI. Here we go. Think probably. Nope, that's not it. Oh, here it is. I bet you. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Here we go. And we are gradually revealing the Quran. Let me reread that. And we are gradually revealing of the Quran that which is a healing and a mercy to the believers, but it only adds to the loss of the wrongdoers. The operative word there is gradually. We are gradually revealing of the Quran, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Next one. 17:107. Same surah. In the Quran, we have revealed in pieces that thou mayest read it to mankind at intervals, and we have sent it down piecemeal. Okie dokie. And the last one is 25:33. And those who disbelieve say, why was not the Quran revealed to him all at once? We have revealed it thus that we may strengthen thy heart therewith, and we have arranged it in the best form. No doubt Muhammad faced criticisms that keep in mind, his first revelation is in 410. I mean, 410. That was the year that Rome was sacked by the Visigoths. No, 610, because he was 40. He was born in 570. 610 was the very first one. And then a couple of years went by with nothing. And then they picked up and apparently just sort of accelerated. Roughly, you might say the Quran is the work of maybe the last 15 or 20 years, somewhere in there, high teens, of his life. So, and I remember way on back, right at the very beginning, I was comparing with Plotinus in that respect, that Plotinus also began writing rather late in life, and about, you know, same time range too. And I mean, just that was in the context of, well, how much can somebody change starting late? First of all, in life, you're not going to likely change as much as if you started writing at age 20. And also, you don't have as long a period to change either. But anyway, apparently, well, not apparently, there are some inconsistencies in the Quran, or potential inconsistencies. And I can well imagine somebody saying, well, wait a minute now. You know, 5 years ago or whatever, you said thus and such. And now you're saying, you said X, and now you're saying Y. Come on. I mean, you know, of course, that would just be grist in the mill of the anti-Muhammad person, right? You're a fake. You know, that we do know that there were people out there saying, well, you know, you're not any different from us. Why didn't you come down with angels if this is, you know, from God and stuff like that and whatever. And, you know, you just made all this stuff up. Or as the Quran says, you know, you forged it, you know, that kind of thing. Well, I mean, think about it. If he had said 5 years ago X and now he's saying Y, well, somebody might say, well, yeah, that's just proof positive that you're just making this stuff and you can't even keep your story straight. Yeah, 5 years ago you were saying something different. Answer: doctrine of abrogation. God knows what's... God understands what you can digest at a given time. It's like, you know, well, I don't know, maybe it's not a good example, but, you know, when you first learn math, you know, you learn 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then 10, we start 2 digits, and then 100, we start 3 digits, and all that sort of thing. And you don't learn really that, well, there are other possible bases. I mean, this didn't become important really until computers, when you have base 2, you know, 1 and 0, the only two digits. But I mean, base 10 is only one of an infinite number of possible bases. I mean, the Sumerians used to have base 60 counting system. That's how we get 60 seconds to the minute, 60 minutes to the hour, ultimately. So anyway, but you learned that later in school. Why did you learn it in elementary school? Well, because it's too advanced. It's too abstract. I mean, you wouldn't be able to teach a six-year-old about other bases, you know. So you learn base 10 first. And then later, when you get into high school, maybe you learn, well, you can also count in, you know, base 2, say, or base 16, which is a power of 2. That's useful as well, hexadecimal counting system, stuff like that. The Quran's like that. God understands what you can absorb at any given time. And so God delivers X at time T1. And now you're a little more advanced. You've been exposed to this, and you're kind of thinking along those lines. And so now you can handle something a little more difficult, perhaps. And so then you have Y at time T2. That's what abrogation really boils down to. Now, Muhammad doesn't say this, but I can well imagine it being extended to much more broadly, because, of course, Islam is always open to the people of the book, right? And Muslims are not the only people of the book. You have Jews and Christians out there. The Jews have their Torah, and the Christians have their gospel, to use the language of the Quran. Well, gospel is later than the Torah, and the Quran is later than the gospel, right? So I would imagine that, and they certainly don't agree with one another. We know that. And so I can well imagine, even though the Quran doesn't explicitly do this, but it sort of implies it, I think, that, anything in the gospel that's inconsistent with the Torah would abrogate the latter, and anything in the Quran that's inconsistent with the gospel or the Torah would abrogate those as well. So I can imagine the doctrine of abrogation being extended quite a bit beyond just the internals of the Quran itself. But anyway, that's a clever way of getting rid of inconsistencies. And lest you think that that's peculiar to Islam, it's not. For example, in Thomas Aquinas, I mean, this is just the one that occurs to me, in Thomas Aquinas, he's talking about the doctrine of law, and he's talking about laws from the Old Testament, the Old Law. And he divides up the laws of the Old Testament into three categories, but the category that's pertinent here is the ceremonial precepts of the Old Law. And what does he say? Well, for one thing, he repeats the very old Christian idea that circumcision was replaced by baptism. You know, well, circumcision was a sacrament in the Hebrew faith, but then we have now baptism, and so that abrogates, let's use that word, that abrogates the previous rite. And that's true for all, because, I mean, you look at the book of Leviticus, you know, and all the stuff about, well, how do we do our sacrifices, you know, and this construction of the tabernacle and all this stuff and the various rituals you go through and whatever. All that is now, as we used to say when I was in the Army, OBE, overtaken by events, right? Christianity has now replaced those sacraments with others, and so they've been abrogated. So, I mean, we do have in Christian theology, there is a doctrine of abrogation, really, in the sense of the second sense that I was talking about with respect to the Quran.
And Don, can I ask here?
Yeah.
Well, let's, you know, in the Christian case, is that doctrine being applied when often people want to wash aside old statements from the Bible that are merely inconvenient?
Yes. Well,
not, you know.
Yeah. Of course, it's kind of a go-to excuse, which is, I guess, what you're implying. But it would have to be on the basis of, well, this is earlier and this is later, because that's the idea behind it. It's a temporal sort of thing. So the later one cancels out the earlier one. If that's what you're saying, yes, indeed, it could be used that way.
So you shouldn't use abrogation for things that have not been replaced by later scripture, but people are just think they're out of date.
Yeah, well, you know, that's right. Well, okay, you're talking about like a secular abrogation? In other words, we're smarter now than they were back when the Bible was written, so we can abrogate it in the light of modern psychology.
Well, let's just take a simple case about, you know, the relationship of men and women to each other.
Oh, I see what you mean. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, yes, of course. Well, that all goes back.
Where the old scripture is inconvenient.
I get you. In that case, it's not so much a question of abrogation, because I want to confine that to, you know, the idea. Well, in the Christian tradition, you have this idea of progressive revelation, which is similar to the part of the doctrine of abrogation that God reveals whatever is appropriate for your level of sophistication. And later on, God may reveal something more, like teaching you the base theory and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, the doctrine of progressive revelation in Christian theology is kind of like that, right? God doesn't just dump it all at once. God reveals it piecemeal, just like the Quran says, you know, piecemeal. So I would prefer to confine abrogation to that. What you're talking about is something a little different, I think. I think what you're talking about is an epistemological question, really, having to do with the relationship between reason and revelation. Are you a rationalist or are you a revelationist, if there is such a word? And is it the case that revelation then, Allah said, somebody like Thomas Aquinas, supersedes reason? I mean, for Aquinas, you know, we can know only up to here through rational means, and then revelation supplements that. Sort of the reverse would be what you're referring to, that, yeah, the Bible is inconvenient. We're more morally sensitive now than they were back in the day. And so we prefer our own moral insights to what we read in the Bible. That would be what you're saying. I just wouldn't call that abrogation. It may be similar, you know, but abrogation technically is confined to, you know, within the religious, either book or the religious tradition. Does that make sense?
All right. It's just, you know, it's so open-ended, but I guess everybody knows that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all I'm saying is, yeah, what you're talking about is something similar. I'm not sure I would call it abrogation because that has a more technical meaning. That's all I'm saying. I'm just kind of quibbling about the terms. Yeah. But yeah, there's certainly problems. Yes, yes, yes.
It seems like this doctrine of abrogation is in tension with a couple of other things. The notion that the Quran is eternal and the notion that Muhammad is the seal of the prophets and that the Quran is now, you know, finished.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, in the first one, I think I can explain that one away. The Quran is eternal, but it's you can think of it as as sort of time-based eternal in the sense that imagine God's book up there, God's book, you know, includes the Quran, and imagine that every verse is time-stamped.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And so God is a reminder. So God, you know, okay, what do I do today? Okay, this one and this one and this one. Okay, we'll do this, you know, that kind of thing. Or maybe every surah is time stamped, something like that. So you can still talk about temporal relations in an eternal universe, right? As long as they're time stamped, even though God wouldn't see them in the same way we do, but they're still time stamped. So that's the answer to your first one. The second one, interestingly, I don't know if this is what you mean, but in some ways, once you've passed that era in the religion's history, you almost thereafter have a doctrine of reverse abrogation. So for example, just what we're familiar with, and this is true for Islam as well as Christianity, but let's use Christianity because we're familiar with it. The Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation was big on reverse abrogation, really, right? Because here's the thinking of people like Luther, okay? There was this era in Christianity that is embodied, say, in the book of Acts, when the church was pristine, everybody loved everybody, they shared everything equally, blah, 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 all this myth. But anyway, there it is, you know, this idea. And look at what's happened in the centuries in between, up to now. Holy cow! We got popes. We got a college of cardinals. We got saints galore. We got sacraments all over the place. All this stuff, all this junk that got accreted to the pure, crystalline beauty of the primitive church. The primitive church is up here. It's on a pedestal. And all this junk that's got accreted to the church, what do we need to do? Sweep it all away. Just throw it out and get back to that pure flood. To that pure doctrine. Go ahead.
We need another flood.
What was that?
We need another flood.
Yeah. that's all like a reverse abrogation, right? We're getting back to the supposedly pure version of Christianity. And, of course, the same is true in Islam. I mean, what do you think these Al-Qaeda folks are doing who insist that you have to grow a beard if you're a man, you have to cover yourself up if you're a woman? We got to get back to the 7th century. You know, that's when Islam was pure. That's when we had the four righteous caliphs. Everybody was pulling for the same thing. Everybody recognized that the prophet was, you know, delivering the word of God. And look what's happened in the intervening centuries. Corruption like you wouldn't believe. Men shave their beards. Women are going around with their hair uncovered. Next thing you know, we're all going to be, you know, just in a world of orgies or something. You know, we got to get back to the 7th century. And we're going to do it come, you know, hell or high water, basically. You know, we're going to make sure we get right back to that 7th century. I can quote Billy Graham, by the way. I just read this the other day. You may have seen it. I can't remember where I saw it. But somebody was saying, this is typical Protestantism, somebody was saying to Billy Graham, you're going to put the church back 50 years. And Billy Graham replied, I hope to put the church back 2,000 years. Once again, this myth, back in the days of the early church, that was the primitive church. That was the ideal, and we got to get back to that. You know, I don't care which religion you're talking about, we got to get back to whatever was the, you know, the founding era of that religion. It's that temptation, but it's kind of a reverse abrogation in some ways, which is just the opposite of what Tom was talking about. Just the opposite of that. So, yeah.
Right. Well, I guess I still think these things are kind of in conflict, because the idea that, you know, yes, the Quran is eternal, but it's time stamped.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's only time stamped between the period from, you know, 610 to whenever it was finished and the seal was applied. And so during that period, you know, people were evolving, and you maybe originally you could only tell them certain things, but then later on you can now tell them, you know, now they understand that there are different, you know, numeric bases and hexadecimal and whatever. So you can explain that. Well, but then whenever the Quran is then sealed, from then on afterwards, there's no further evolution of human understanding where you would need to give them different principles.
Yeah, that's right. But there can be evolution. There can be theological evolution, of course. There simply can't be.
Well, it shouldn't be, because the Quran is clear.
Yeah, right. I see what you're saying. Yeah, of course. I mean, you could be a radical anti-theologian. You could say we need to throw out theology, because that's just an intellectual construction. Let's just get back to reading the Quran, you know, something like that. I mean, I think actually Karl Barth was a bit like that, you know. You know, if you're asked a theological question, you don't even bother to answer it. You just go right back and recite a Bible verse or something. That's all we're interested in, yeah. But, I mean, isn't that kind of a reverse abrogation position?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if this is the climax, then why would you need anything else? In fact, why would I ever? I should just go out and burn down all the libraries. We don't need any other books. This is the only book we need. Let's just spend the whole rest of the human history reading the Quran, maybe memorizing it. That's all we need. So I'm not sure it's inconsistent. I mean, like you were saying, yeah. It just implies that this is it. This is the, you know, we're right there. Just need to get back to it.
Right, and there can be no further abrogation. You're done. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. If there's no other revelations, then there's no other abrogation. I mean, this is it. Yeah. Any other questions, comments?
There's a difference between what the Quran said about very specific things back in the day and how it applies to modern times.
Well, but then
let's just say whether you should get vaccinated or not.
I know.
Well, there's no such thing in the Quran.
Of course.
Or whether you're allowed to watch movies that have women in them.
Yes, I know. That is the problem. I mean, that's the fatal problem behind any desire just to wind the clock back, because you can't wind the clock back. Time, there is an intervening period of time between the time the Quran was written and 2021. You can't pretend that none of that ever happened. You can't do it. I don't care what Al-Qaeda or Islamic State wants to do. You can't do it. I don't care what Billy Graham wants to do. You can't do it. You know, so that is a problem for that position. So I think, you know, that's what you're saying. You're saying basically that the position is just not gonna work. It's just impractical. So you do indeed.
Well, although the people may have a better case when they refer to specific parts of the Quran that make very explicit statements, like Don, I don't know about the beards thing, but if it says in the Quran that all men must wear beards.
I don't remember but
you know, if something is quite specific.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah, yeah. Well, but we have problems, don't we, in Christianity? You know what's really interesting? This is totally aside, but it is interesting, isn't it, how you can learn a lot about your own religion by examining somebody else's. Because, you know, you can look at it objectively, and then you think, oh, wait a minute, it's the same, or it's something analogous over here. Look, I don't care how hard you try and how contorted you get yourself into, but I can't see that the Bible is pro-LGBT. Or for that matter, anti-slavery. Really? I mean, you know, people say, oh, well, how about Exodus? Well, the thing, look, I mean, God's problem with as I read it anyway, God's problem with the enslavement of the children of Israel was that it was the children of Israel, God's chosen people, who were being enslaved. It wasn't the problem with slavery. It was the problem with who was being enslaved. And, you know, Paul, he's okay with slavery. You know that. There are rules about slaves in Leviticus, you know, just an assumed, social convention. And Jesus doesn't have anything to say about slavery. So, I don't see it. I mean, certainly, the whole anti-slavery movement that began in the 18th century was a huge moral advancement. But only if you read the Bible allegorically, or read the Bible in a more less literal fashion than the defenders of slavery did. You read some of those controversies back in the 18th and 19th centuries. I mean, a lot of them had to do with biblical, they wanted to get the Bible on their side, you know. The mark of Cain, what was that? You know, that sort of thing. So, we got a real problem there, you know, in terms of the question, and this is the question that Tom raised 20 minutes ago, you know. Are we going to be biblical literalists and throw out any sort of rational conclusion that would oppose what the Bible literally is saying? Or are you going to try to contort yourself into some sort of pretzel to somehow get out of this, you know, some sort of pro-LGBT thing or anti-slavery position, something like that? The Bible was written centuries ago. Civilization was different back in those days. I'm sorry. You know, so
go ahead. Question about the idea of the people of the book, and getting back to what did Muhammad think of the other two books. My impression was that he had said, when he first started hearing from Gabriel, mm-hmm. and I think I got this from Karen Armstrong, that he said, it's about time that God spoke to our people, because mm-hmm. he has spoken to the Jews and he's spoken to the Christians. But what you've been reading us is abrogating a lot of Christian and Jewish stuff. I wonder how Muhammad dealt with that idea. Well, what did God, why did he tell them this and that, and he's telling me something different?
Well, I think it's the same reason. It's like it's analogous to the progressive revelation theory in Christian theology. God reveals whatever people can handle at that given time. I mean, all I'm doing is extending what, think of it this way, this is my own terminology, internal abrogation and external abrogation, internal to the Quran and external to the Quran. So what you find in the Quran is internal abrogation theory, and all I'm saying is it's not that difficult to extend it to external abrogation to include the Torah and the Gospels as well. But it would be the same theory underlying it. In other words, that God reveals whatever human beings can absorb at a given time, and at a later time God reveals it. I mean, God understands that they can handle something else, and so then that gets revealed and it, you know, abrogates what was there before.
And so what's in the Quran is what's really true.
Yeah, of course, because that's
the other things were just little bits.
Yeah, yeah. They were, you know, and some of those things, from before still persist, right? In the same way that Thomas Aquinas says, well, the moral precepts are just as valid today as the day they came down from Mount Sinai, you know? But the ceremonial precepts are the ones that have been abrogated. So it's the same kind of thing here. He's not saying that that Torah is 100% false. He's not saying that. The Torah, after all, affirms monotheism. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. But, you know, some of this. So only some doctrines get abrogated.
Yeah. Well, you'd like to think, though, that the Quran would allow for a successor to Muhammad to fine-tune what people could handle at some future date, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if the caliph, of course, the caliph, really, historically, was really more of a political figure than a religious figure, but a religiously sanctioned political figure, at least. But, you know, that gets... But in the Shiite tradition, of course, you have this Mahdi idea, who really is a sort of a combination... Sort of like a theocratic sort of thing, right? I mean, it's sort of a combination of political and religious figure. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, right. You know, you're right. And certain strains of Islam do indeed agree with what you just said. You know, we keep on needing authorities to guide our thinking. And in the Shiite tradition, it's this Mahdi business going on. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Well, we're schmoozing into another topic here, but, you know, this is all kind of just gradually going through. And that has to do with, and you can think of this as sort of like a summary of what we've been talking about. And I want to read you one passage. Boy, what color did I use here? Huh, I guessed right. Think of what I'm going to talk about now as sort of a... kind of standing back and looking at the whole expanse of the 25 prophets and just seeing it in as a whole. Okay, I'm going to start with the following verse. This is Surah number 10, verse 48. And for every people, there is a messenger. This is sort of analogous to what Marty was saying a minute ago, or maybe Tom. I forget somebody. And for every people, there is a messenger. So, when their messenger comes, it is judged between them with equity, and they are not wronged. You'll notice here, I said this earlier, but I didn't give you a citation. But you'll notice here the phrasing. It's not for every person, it's for every people. Right? For every people, there is a messenger. So in other words, this idea of these prophets is not... I mean, Muhammad is simply not thinking in terms of individuals. Muhammad is thinking in terms of groups. For every people, there is a messenger. So, you know, Noah, the people of Noah. Hud, and Salih, and Shuaib, and, you know, the people of the wood. And Moses, you know, the Pharaoh, and so forth. And, you know, Jesus. I mean, so... Many, many messengers, these warners, have come out over the span of centuries. And they are messengers to a people, to a people. So that's really important, just to keep in mind that it's not individually focused, but group focused. Okay. And then, and this sort of summarizes everything that we've been talking about for the last lots of weeks. This is Surah 23:102-112. And when the trumpet is blown, there will be no ties of relationship between them that day, nor will they ask after one another. Then those whose good works are heavy, these will be prosperous. But those whose good works are light, these are they who ruin their souls. In hell they will abide. The fire will burn their faces, and they will grin with fear therein. Were not my signs recited unto you, and you treated them as lies? They will say, Our Lord, our wickedness overcame us, and we were an erring people. Our Lord, take us out of this. Then if we return to disobedience, we shall indeed be wrongdoers. God will say, Away with you! Despise therein, and speak not unto me. There was a party from among my servants who said, Our Lord, we believe, forgive us therefore our sins, and have mercy on us, for thou art the best of those who show mercy. But you made a laughingstock of them until they became the cause of your forgetting my remembrance while you continued laughing at them. I have rewarded them this day for their steadfastness, so that they alone have triumphed. Okay. And again, this is, where am I? 25, 23 through 27. I'm going to there. On the day when they see the angels, there will be no good tidings on that day for the guilty. And they will say, Would that there were a great barrier. And we shall turn to the works they did, and we shall scatter it into particles of dust. The inmates of heaven on that day will be better off as regards their abode, and better off in respect of their place of repose. And the day when the heaven shall be rent asunder with the clouds, and the angels shall be sent down in large numbers, the true kingdom shall that day belong to the gracious God, and it shall be a hard day for the disbelievers. Yeah. Well, you know, those two passages, I think, very nicely summarize the eschatology of the Quran. I mean, that and that's one that's, you know, one of the big messages in the Quran. You know, God sends down messengers to every people out there. I know we've talked about, well, what about the Chinese and the South Sea Islanders, whatever. God sends down messengers to every people out there. The message is in their vernacular. Message, you know, Noah presumably spoke Hebrew, right? And that sort of stuff. The message in the vernacular is completely clear. They have no excuse. You know, there is no God but Allah. There is no God but Allah. Six words. Which of those six words do you not understand? So, completely clear. You have no excuse. Then when the trumpet shall sound and the angels come down, there will be those who spend eternity in the gardens of delight, pleasures beyond end, and there will be those who writhe in agony in the burning fires of hell forever and ever and ever and ever. That's it. Complete bifurcation. So I think, you know, those three passages very nicely summarize everything we've talked about. So I kind of am hesitant to get into the next topic. Does anybody have any questions or comments, or objections or anything?
Don, when you were talking about there is no God but Allah, I was thinking, well, that sounds very clear. I mean, you're arguing it is very clear, yeah. But, it doesn't say there is no moral authority except for Allah. It doesn't even say there is no, supernatural beings except for Allah.
Mm.
So where does that leave you?
Yeah.
Listening to the prophets, listening to other people, other entities that may be demigods, or even listening to your own moral reasoning.
Well, of course, it's consistent with there being jinn,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, we have jinn out there. I think you're making a distinction that I think would not have been recognized between, you might say, temporal authority and moral authority. You know what I mean? Between pure power and moral authority. I'm not sure that, Muhammad, I mean, it's almost Hobbesian. I mean, if you want to operate with that kind of distinction, Hobbes, remember, argues that there is no absolute justice, there is no absolute good. It's whatever God says is just or good that is just or good. And then when you get down to the the human world. It's whatever the sovereign says is just or good. It's just or good. God is pro-sovereign, so they don't have a problem there. So I don't think that distinction you're making is even envisioned here, because God is the master of the universe, and then God can tell you what is good and what is evil, just as Al-Ashari had said. I quote him all the time because it was such a shocking statement. He says, if God had willed that lying be good, then lying would be good. So there is no independent standard for morality at all. It's whatever God says morality is.
We haven't gotten to them yet, but there are the five pillars of Islam.
Well, yeah, we'll get there. We will get there.
Those are the things that you are specifically told to do.
Yeah, exactly. And why should you do them? Because God said so. That's why. I mean, some of them don't necessarily even make any sense. Why should I go to visit Mecca once in my life? Why should I do that? Because God said so. That's why. I don't need to tell you any other reason. It's like a bad parent. You know, don't do as I, you know, why should I do this? Because I said so. Yes. Yes.
A lot of them do make sense, though.
Yeah, oh, sure. Give alms.
Give alms.
Yeah.
Welcoming the stranger, you know, whatever, being there.
I agree. There's a mixture there. That was, in the Middle Ages, they distinguished between laws of reason and laws of tradition. And give alms as a law of reason makes sense. Others, like the pilgrimage, are laws of tradition. Tom, you look like you want to say something.
Don, I'm sure that you as a parent, you use progressive revelation on your children, saying, you will understand later.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Right?
Yeah. I'm not saying that that's necessarily bad. I'm all for the way of teaching math that way. Yeah.
And what you need is one of your kids to come back someday and say, Dad, you know, you were right. Now I understand.
I think my kids have finally reached the point where they do appreciate their parents. They've been there for about a decade, I'd say. Yeah. Pat, were you going to say something? I thought you were starting to say something a second ago.
Well, I was just thinking about Jesus explicitly was trying to argue against the existing authorities of his time, the political and temporal authorities.
Right.
Are you saying Muhammad was not?
No, he was. Right? I mean, the whole deal was, this is polytheism, right? He's complaining about the polytheism of his own society. So in that sense, he's very Jesusian.
Right, so that's different than the Hobbesian argument that the sovereign is.
Oh, I see what you mean. I see what you mean. Well, I was thinking of it in terms of God, though. You know, Hobbes obviously extends it to the sovereign, but yeah, just in terms of God. God has the power to make the rules, and that's all there is to it. Yeah.
Right. So Muhammad was explicitly arguing, you should not be listening to these existing temporal authorities who are preaching polytheism.
Yes,
you have to listen to me.
That is true, because I'm reporting what God is saying, and God's authority trumps anything temporal. Yeah, we got to quit. It's we got 1 minute. So, hey, this is great fun, isn't it? So we'll see you next week, and we'll get into the business about salvation and stuff like that. So anyway, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.